Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Empowering Family Caregivers on Blog Talk Radio. I am Susan Bida, your host and co-founder of eCareDiary.com. We're a leading online community for family caregivers managing all the diverse aspects of elder care. We're a centralized resource providing the targeted content and shows such as this and unique online tools that caregivers need to manage care. So thank you for tuning in after Thanksgiving, a long Thanksgiving Day weekend. I'd like to remind everyone that you can listen to any of our past shows on eCareDiary.com by clicking on our blog tab and going down to the Blog Talk Radio show. And we encourage you to register for our free newsletter to learn more about our upcoming shows. So November, and we are still in the month of November, even though I feel like we're inching closely to December. November is National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month, as well as National Family Caregivers Month. And in honor of these two themes, I am very pleased to introduce today's guest, who is Brenda Avadian, an Alzheimer's caregiver survivor, advocate, and award-winning spokesperson for families and professional caregivers. Brenda is an internationally acclaimed author of 8 books, including the pioneering Where's My Shoes? My Father's Walk Through Alzheimer's. She also wrote a book series called Finding the Joy in Alzheimer's. Brenda embarked on her personal journey as a caregiver when she had to take care of her late father who suffered from Alzheimer's disease and has never looked back since then. She is also the founder of thecaregiversvoice.com, where she provides information, support, and resources to bring joy to families and professionals who serve brain-impaired adults caused by Alzheimer's, stroke, or trauma. Brenda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Brenda, I also want to thank you for writing Where's My Shoes? I hadn't realized that all the proceeds from the book go towards helping people with Alzheimer's as well as their families. So thank you for that.
Well, we've been doing it for 11 years.
Wonderful.
The first edition and now the second.
Exactly. So it's money well spent and going into the right place. So thank you for that. Now, Brenda, you know, you obviously have quite a story to tell. And could you share some of it with us? Could you tell us how you became a caregiver?
You know, I think about that because people ask me that a lot. Caregiver? I go, huh. To let everyone know, if anybody were to have said to me, Brenda, about 3 months even before I became a caregiver, if anybody was to say, Brenda, you're going to become a caregiver in fall. So they're saying this to me earlier. I would ask what kind of medications they were on. And I allow me to just say that how my husband and I became caregivers involves a DUI. Now, it's not what you think. But it's close. And I'll share an abbreviated 2 to 3 minute version of the story that'll kind of set context for how we got involved so that your listeners can get a sense of who I am and my story. But after my mother died, my father began to decline. He would get lost on the expressway from Wisconsin to Illinois. He'd lock himself out of his house. He'd visit the bank daily to ensure that they wouldn't forget about him or his money. He wouldn't shower or he wouldn't change his clothes. In fact, when my husband and I visited him in March in his home of 45 years in Wisconsin, you know, he had a set of clothes on. And when I went to go see him again later that year in August, he had the same clothes on, except they were dirtier and he smelled and looked worse than a homeless person. And the list goes on and on. And after trying to enlist my brothers and sister's support, my brother who lived in our father's home and my sister who lived 5 blocks away, it wasn't until the County Department of Aging health care worker contacted me 2,000 miles away and said something must be done for your father. And it was that August then that I went and visited my father after his and my birthdays, which we were both born on August 22nd. So let me just share a few more things here because I think this is key. When I went to go see him in August, I had four care options for him. One, that we could have somebody live in his home with him and care for him because my brother seemed to be neglecting him. We could move him into assisted living. We could have him live with us, which was a laugh, really, because my husband and I were really busy traveling. We were focused on our careers. We didn't have children. Sure. So we only had three independent cats at the time, so all you have to do is feed and clean up after them, but that's it. And then the fourth option was just to spend the time with him and return home. But in spending that time with him, he began to open up, and I began to help him. And his limitless stuff, his paperwork, all that grew. I got tired of the paperwork. I grew flustered, and I kept saying to him, why don't you just visit us? I wanted him to escape all this stuff. Why don't you just visit us? And when he finally agreed, it only took me 3 years since my mother died to persuade him to visit us. But when he agreed, I asked my husband to come out, and I said, you need to come out and make sure he honors his promise because, you know, you're a man and he's a chauvinistic male, so he'll trust you and listen to you. So we went to, after my husband got involved in the paperwork, we both got so frustrated that here's where the DUI comes in. We went to an Oktoberfest celebration in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And right. In Milwaukee, which beer made famous, when you order a sampler, they give you not the 4 or 5 ounce ones that we get on either coast.
Right.
Like in your coast or my coast here in California, but they give you 16 ounce samplers of samplers. And we did order these 16 ounce samplers and kept drinking until we began to philosophize about the options for my father's care. And that's when we had the DUI. We decided under the influence to have my father come live with us.
I love that, DUI, deciding under the influence.
That's right. And this is why you'll always hear me say, I don't recommend you becoming a caregiver like I did. Yet how many of our listeners today can tell a similar story of how they ended up being on that caregiving road by taking this unmarked detour? It may not have been a DUI, but it could have been something else. So that's
absolutely
the story.
That's an amazing story. But I want to go back here a second because I think the beginning of your story is pretty shocking to me. I mean, the fact that you had a brother who was living with your father and, you know, a sister who lived 5 blocks away. I guess my question is, were you all in a bit of denial about your father's mental condition, or were they in denial about his condition? And what steps had to be taken for his for all of you to understand, you know, where he stood mentally?
Susan, denial is one way of looking at it. And I'm just going to say he was such an independent being. He was born in 1910 in Armenia. He escaped with his mother from an affluent, predominantly Armenian town after his father was murdered during the Armenian genocide. He was an immigrant to this country at the age of 10. He learned to support himself early on.
Yeah.
So when I look at a man like this, and I come into his life on his 49th birthday, okay, half of his life he's lived. I wanted to do everything I could to preserve his independence and dignity. So yet, how do you weigh this between acting too soon and not soon enough? And
right.
These are the insecurities due to the uncertainty of caregiving. Once we moved him into our home, we wasted no time in getting recommendations for an assessment, you know, for him and to a geriatric assessment center, and we took him in for a complete assessment. But I think what my sister told me that my brother's approach was that he would just wait, you know, until my father, something major happened, and then he would have him committed to a county facility.
Right.
My sister was kind of limited in her options to help because my father wouldn't even give a key to her for the house. So, you know, when he'd lock himself out, they'd have to find a different way to get in because he wouldn't, you know, they'd have to go through a lot of trouble.
Right.
So I think, you know, he was still trying to preserve his independence. And it wasn't until he agreed to visit us that right. I bought him that one-way ticket.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You know, you know, when you say denial, even when I look back on it now, and I just say it had to be that weighing of, you know, I want to preserve his dignity. On the other hand, there's these county officials who know more
right.
because they deal with this. And so they opened my eyes to it a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, he still retained that independence.
Yeah, I think that's why it's so hard sometimes, I think, with Alzheimer's, especially with our parents, that, you know, so much of who they are kind of remains with them. But then there are these little signs that start showing up, which we'll talk about in a bit. Having read your book, I have to say every moment of your journey seems so trying and so painful, and the relationship between you and your sister and your brother, I mean, I found myself angry at them. And I wanted to ask, if you don't mind, why were they so completely unwilling to work with you?
You know, I don't mind you asking at all. In fact, I have to confess, I wish I knew. The only explanation that I can think of is that we were raised competitively. My brother was the oldest, my sister next, and then I am the youngest. And I was the biggest loser in every single competition, whether it came to height, age, grades, et cetera. I'm serious. I mean, I was the biggest loser. And this is perhaps why, despite why today, you know, you look at business and everybody talks about competition. And despite my gregarious appearing personality, I seek to collaborate anytime there's any hint of competition. I just absolutely hate competition. And I don't know why they weren't willing to work with me, except that sometimes they would say they were too busy. Actually, often they'd say they were too busy. And since, you know, I took it on, they didn't want to be involved. But I have to tell you the funny thing. While my brother lived in our father's home, and I moved my father out of his home into ours, it was 6 months before I heard anything from my brother. Now, if I were living in my dad's home and all of a sudden he disappeared and never came back for 6 months, I think it would take me about one day to start making some phone calls and wonder what happened. But in 6 months, there was never a single inquiry. The only time I got a response was when we said we're going to sell the house. He needs to get out of there.
That's incredible. That's really incredible.
So,
but, you know, maybe on the other hand, it's a blessing because there are families who everyone wants to be involved, and then that becomes a problem too. So maybe.
Well, it was. It was. I mean, they did throw obstacles. And I have to say, you know, when it comes to the challenges of caregiving, I think the challenges of caregiving for me were more around my father's paperwork and the administrative and the legal issues than it was actually caring for my dad.
Well, let's turn to that topic, because why don't you tell us about how you became your father's power of attorney, and then in Wisconsin, they use the term legal guardian, correct? Whereas
right.
in California, they call it conservator.
I think so. Well, the power of attorney, guardianship, and conservatorship are three different things. The power of attorney began when my father would ask me when I was visiting him for the 2 weeks. He'd say, come to the bank with me. He says, I want to make sure they don't forget about me. I want to make sure they remember, you know, they don't take my money away thinking that I'm no longer here. So every day he'd want me to go to the bank. Well, the tellers, he's been banking with them for decades. So they knew him, but you know, they were getting understandably irritated. So one of them finally told me, why don't you become his power of attorney? And I says, what is that? And they said, you can, you know, have legal authorization assigned for him and, you know, monitor his statements and that kind of thing. So my father liked the way I was helping him and, you know, the way I'd be able to answer his questions and show him proof. So he says, yeah, that's a good idea. So he signed off on my becoming his power of attorney. Well, that was just to the banks. I had to go to an attorney to get a formal power of attorney, especially since my brother and sister and I were contentious in our relationship, I did not want to take my father out of his home in Wisconsin, move him here in California, and be accused of kidnapping if I didn't have some kind of legal document.
Sure.
So I talked to the County Department on Aging. They gave me a list of like 10 elder law attorneys because they can't really recommend one. And I called several.
They're a very good source for that information. I just want to point that out. I think a lot of people don't know even where to turn in the first place, and you found them helpful, at least with the list of elder law attorneys.
Right, and I called several because this was right before Labor Day weekend, but I did settle with one, and he was very helpful, drafted a power of attorney, asked my father questions. My father was able to answer them, even though, you know, he was starting that dementia and going in and out and that lucidity versus non, but he was able to answer them, and so we went through with that. You know, we got the power of attorney, and I kept that document with me when we moved him to California.
Right. Well, Brenda, it just seems to me you took on this responsibility, I think. You dove in head first, and it seems that you were learning so much as you were going, and once you moved your father, and you call him Mardik, is that the correct pronunciation of his name?
Exactly. Mardik. Yeah, Mardik is why we call him that. I know your listeners will say, why do you call your dad Mardik? But that's, I mean, for some reason we started calling him that from little on.
Yeah. So you brought Mardik into your home. You moved him out of Milwaukee to your home in Los Angeles. That must have been incredible. I mean, an incredible transition, not only for him, but for you and your husband as well. What support services did you find especially helpful as you were, you and your husband, you know, I understand you also worked and traveled as well.
It started with my dear friend and adopted mom, Sally, whose father also was attending an adult daycare center, and she first of all was surprised, knowing she knew us very well, and she was surprised we decided to do this. But again, going back to that DUI that I don't recommend, but she recommended adult daycare. Adult daycare support group recommended a geriatric assessment center, and about another support group, which was the Los Angeles Caregiver Resource Center, who then, it went from one to the next, the Alzheimer's Association, then online chats. And the best way that I just went from one organization to the next, to the next, to the next, was all through referrals.
Wonderful.
And so that's how we learn.
That's amazing. And I remember reading about the story of adult daycare where your father really loved to work his entire life. He liked being productive, and the adult daycare was actually able to, you know, play along with him and so that he would actually go, because I think there was a point in the story where you were concerned that he may not go if you framed it as an adult daycare, but if you framed it as a place where he could go work, that he would actually be willing.
And the adult daycare center staff are very good. I mean, some people are on cruises, some people are working, like my father, and every Friday when they present me with the bill, because I was paying privately for it, my father thought it was his paycheck, and he was aware enough that he was living with us and he wanted to contribute his share to the expenses. So the way the adult daycare center and I framed it is that this envelope was his paycheck. And so he never even wanted to see it. He figured, you know, we can have it since he was living with us.
Wow. These are all wonderful stories. I mean, they're so touching. And tell us now about the title of the book, Where's My Shoe?
Well, Susan, you know how all of our loved ones with moderate dementia ask the one question. I mean, did you and your husband have that one question that you were asked all the time that you said, if I ever hear that again? Okay, you did. You're laughing, so I'm assuming. May I ask what yours was?
Yeah. No, well, I mean, it was different with my father-in-law.
Oh.
My father-in-law had Parkinson's, and we were always asked to do many things. There wasn't, you know, my grandfather is the one who actually has the dementia, and he always asks my cousin on this point about, you know, where I don't know. He usually asks about his you know, some article of clothing or his sweater, you know. So
right.
Yes,
where's my purse? Where's my shirt? Anyway, so in our family, we don't wear shoes in the house. I love to sit and lie on the floor, so it keeps the floors cleaner. And besides, my traditionally male chauvinist father believed that a man has to have his shoes on, in his case, his leather wing-tipped shoes, before going outside or walking anywhere. You know, no sandals, no slippers, no socks for my dad. A real man needs his shoes. So he'd, he'd take them off when we tell him, remember, take your shoes off. So he'd take them off, but very soon after he'd put them back on because that was his comfort level. Well, the secondary reason we wanted to have them off is because they provided an obstacle to his wandering. He would get out of the house frequently, so they provided an obstacle. If he couldn't find them, he wouldn't leave the house. So we would hide them. So he'd always ask us, where's my shoes? And for the grammarians of our listeners today, yes, it is grammatically incorrect. It should be, where are my shoes? And my father would ask that way, but he had dementia. So he'd say, where's my shoes? And I heard that so much, I said, the next time I hear that, I'm going to just strangle the person I hear that from. And yet, when we met to talk about the title of the book, that's the one they came up with. And I said, I've got to live with this for the rest of my life. So anyway.
Oh, well, it really does capture.
Yeah, that's the humor of it all.
I mean, you know, it's sad, but yes, we have to find humor in all of this, don't we?
We do. And I have to ask one thing here. Now, this is your show, but I have to ask because I blogged on my website on Facebook and all that, and I told your listeners, I said, gee, you know, you can call in. So if you got any callers, you run that. But, I made that promise, so I don't want to be a liar.
No, absolutely. We definitely have our lines open here. So,
good.
But I do want to get to this one point that you make in your series, and you talk about finding the joy in Alzheimer's or caregiving. You know, you had an incredibly challenging experience caring for your father. Where did you find joy in the disease and in caregiving?
Well, I'll tell you how it goes. One afternoon, a Sunday afternoon, my husband, my dad, and I are sitting in the family room, and we're talking. And I never remember what we talk about, but all I know is that we had a difference of opinion. And my father was not happy about that difference. So all of a sudden he stopped, got up, you know, like a child, pounded his feet across the family room floor, went toward the hallway, froze, turned around, looked at David, my husband, and said, where's my room? I mean, he didn't even ask. It was like more like a demand. So David got up and he says, Martik, I'll show you where it is. So he gets up and walks with my dad. My dad follows David down the hall. So I get up and I follow because I'm just curious about this. I've never seen this happen before. And my dad was profoundly deaf. So as David is leading, my dad's in the middle, I'm in the back. I go, David. He turns around and he looks and I pretend like I'm strangling my father's neck. And David starts laughing. And then I start laughing, and my dad turns around, looks at David, wondering, you know, because my dad's angry. Looks at David, sees David laughing, and then he turns and looks at who David's looking at, me, and I look at my dad like a Cheshire cat, you know, with that grin. And my dad starts smiling. Well, then I crack up laughing even harder because I can't believe how my dad was so angry, and now all of a sudden he's smiling. I mean, that complete change of emotion. And so then David continues laughing, I'm laughing, then my dad starts laughing. So we're all standing there in the hallway laughing, not knowing my dad has now forgotten why we're there. And then he starts leading us back into the family room, and we all sit down, and that was the end of it. And that's the point I'm trying to make is you take these moments that can be frustrating day after day, and you have fun with them. And, you know, when I give my keynote addresses, I always say, I hope there's nobody from Adult Protective Services here to hear me talk about strangling my dad. But, you know, caregivers understand that. They understand that. And that's how we can release that tension. So that's what I mean about finding the joys even when it's terribly difficult.
So is this part of the key to surviving as a caregiver through through the care of a parent with Alzheimer's?
Well, I think the survival comes first because, you know, you've had a couple of shows here in the past on your Blog Talk Radio show where you've had people that have talked about the grim statistics of survival for caregivers, especially over the age of 65. And this leads to one of the three tips I want to make sure we cover in this show, even though we have like 5 minutes left here, is one, learn as much as you can about the disease in order to know what to expect. I mean, this is the key to survival because imagine this, how long will you live driving with your eyes closed? And that's like a caregiver who doesn't know enough about the disease or illness.
Right.
Once you open your eyes and learn about it, you see the road ahead, you know what to expect, and you know how to navigate around them. And
I love that analogy, by the way. I love that analogy, by the way. Yeah.
And thank you. And there's so many resources available depending on where you live, the local organizations, friends, and all that. And we even offer them, too, on our website. But that's the key thing. That's the first one. And I want to provide your listeners two resources, but I'll wait till you tell me that I can do that.
Well, go ahead. Since we're on the subject,
right.
Go ahead.
The two resources that I'd like to offer to your listeners right now is, number one, if they go to thecaregiversvoice.com, we have a nice one-page caregiver's tip sheet. And where they can find that is when they go to the resources and links, and then they click on, or they, you know, just kind of let the cursor rest on informative caregiving articles, and then a menu opens to the right, and it says tips for caregivers. They can see an online version of it there, and then if they scroll down to the bottom, they can also see it, a one-page sheet. The other option I can offer all your listeners is, if they go to the site, thecaregiversvoice.com, and click on free TCV newsletter sign up, all they need to do is throw in their email address. Everything is kept confidential and private. They will get this links to the things I'm talking about. The other thing that I want to offer to your listeners as a resource today is that if they go to thecaregiversvoice.com and just click on products and services along the top bar, and that page that opens, if they scroll down halfway, they'll see holiday special, and they can get a $56 worth of books that includes shipping as well for just $35. We'll pay tax on their shipping just so that they can have these books in hand to use for themselves and to share with family members so that family members can know what they're going through. I mean, I have many older caregivers who buy these who say, I want to give these to my kids so when I need care, they know what to expect. So, I mean,
that's smart.
Those are the resources that I want to offer. And of course, they can write to me, and the links are on the website to do that.
Oh, that's terrific,
Brenda.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for sharing that. Now, I want to get in here your five-minute respite for family caregivers. Can you tell us what that is?
Here's what it boils down to, Susan. You need a break, get respite, or die. I mean,
right.
That may sound funny, but it's true.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah, it is. Too many caregivers over the age of 65 die before their work is finished. And that is that their care recipients live beyond them. So what good was that? I mean, what good is becoming a martyr saying only I can do it as good as I can if I die before my loved one does? And there's plenty of options for caregivers. They can get in-home care. They can send their loved one to a residential care community, assisted living, or even take your mom or your dad to your brother's house who believes you're overreacting to his or her condition, and leave mom or dad there until you get back from Cabo San Lucas or the Fiji Islands. I mean, you know, because sometimes our siblings don't understand what it is, what's involved in taking care of a loved one. They're the ones who say, oh, no, you're making a big deal of it. And I always say, take mom or dad to your brother or sister's house, and then take a one-week, two-week respite to a tropical island and let them experience day after day, 24 hours a day, what it's really like. And then they'll understand what you're going through.
Well, I think your message for getting some form of respite, whether it's with other family members or, you know, getting professionals involved to help is really very key. And I think a lot of caregivers out there need to know that it's okay to do it. you know,
a 5 minute
don't feel guilty about it.
Yeah, so many people say, well, I can't take a break, and that's why I say just 5 minutes. That's all it takes, and that's tip number two, by the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's important.
It absolutely is. Now, knowing what you know now, Brenda, what would you advise families to look for if they suspect their loved one has Alzheimer's?
You know, again, you opened up with this by saying, you know, were we in a bit of denial? And I was talking about that delicate balance.
Yeah.
And I would just say, look, you know, be patient. Don't try to rush the clock. You need to be patient and build trust with your loved one so that your loved one feels confident in your care. And start observing moments of forgetfulness. I mean, my dad used to go visit his brother who had Parkinson's in Illinois. And it was about a 90, 80-mile drive. So he'd get on the expressway in Wisconsin, drive south to Illinois. Well, at one point, he, I guess, got disoriented, pulled over to the side of the road, and began to walk along the expressway until the police picked him up. So, you know, you start making these observations. The police cited him for unsafe driving. The best we can figure out, he was driving on the sidewalk or attempting to, because
right.
he was talking about how people were walking in the streets. So I guess, you know, that's the best I can figure. So you start observing, you put these pieces together, and then you need to make that decision, have him get an assessment and
right.
see a comprehensive assessment, not from your primary care physician, but get a specialist, a geriatric physician, to start that assessment process.
Yes.
I do want to share one tip
yes.
here, can I? The most
Absolutely.
Important tip of all, the most important tip of all, is to ask yourself each day, especially when the going gets tough, how would I want to be cared for if I had my loved one's disease or illness? That's the key point. If I had my loved one's disease or illness, I hear many people talk about the golden rule, how would I want to be cared for? Well, heck, you know, when I'm healthy and confident, my care needs are minimal. But if I have the same insecurities, uncertainties as my loved one who has dementia or Alzheimer's, how would I want to be cared for them? And once we understand that, for me, once I understood that, it turned around my complete caregiving. So learn as much as you can about the disease or illness to know what to expect. Get respite, if even for 5 minutes, and ask yourself, how do I want to be cared for if I had the same disease or illness as my loved one? And the other tips are then at that one page under the resources and links, caregiving, informative caregiving articles, tips for caregivers.
Brenda, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much for being our guest today. Our audience can learn more about Brenda on www.thecaregiversvoice.com. There's no apostrophe in the S. It's thecaregiversvoice.com. I'd like to thank our audience for tuning in. Join us next time on Monday, December 6th at 2 p.m. Eastern, when I will interview Dr. Connie Siskowski. She's the president of the American Association for Caregiving Youth. This is a nonprofit organization that addresses the national phenomenon of over 1.4 million youth under the age of 18 that are caregiving an aging relative. To learn more about eCare Diary and our upcoming shows, visit ecarediary.com. Registration is free and gives you immediate access to the free Care Diary tool. And you can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. I can be found on, my tweet address is ecarediarysusan. Brenda, thank you again. Again, it's thecaregiversvoice.com, and we would love to have you back on our show, Brenda. Thank you again, and
I would love
enjoy
it.
The rest of the holiday.
Thank you.
Best wishes. Bye-bye.